Award-winning playwright David Auburn, Goose Island Beer's chief innovator Mike Siegel, and live music in Studio 435 from singer-songwriter Ezra Furman. And now here's your host, a man who has full-on March Madness, Justin Kaufman.
I'm telling you, man, I have totally gone in on these brackets. My son and I did 64 tournament of music, movies, stuffed animals, books. I'm over it. Seriously, I couldn't tell if it was something he was into or I was into. I really went overboard. Like, there was a point where my wife looked at me and she's like, "What are you doing? Why are you like writing out brackets with top 40 musicians?" So it would be like the number one seed would be Shape of You by Ed Sheeran, you know, and the 16 seed would be like Jealous by Nick Jonas. The winner was Shawn Mendes. He won the whole tournament with a song called Mercy. And then we'd have to play the song.
Were there any upsets?
There were a lot of upsets, and a lot of it was, I mean, it was actually a great experience for me to get to know what my 9-year-old likes.
Mm-hmm.
Movies and what I think he likes. So like I wouldn't show it until I was done. So for instance, on the movies one, we did 64 movies. I was trying to do all superhero movies. Doesn't realize that you'd think that there's like thousands of superhero movies. There's like maybe 70. And then, you know, you got to weed out the ones he hasn't seen. So there were a couple where I'm like, well, I'm just, it's kind of a, anyway, I thought like, for instance, I thought he really liked Star Wars, like Force Awakens. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You would think that's Force Awakens, Rogue One, anything in new stuff because he goes so gaga for it when it's out.
Yeah.
But when it got to the crunch time, Sweet 16, and it had to go up against like a Spy Kids.
Really?
Spy Kids with the victory. Shark Boy and Lava Girl beat Rogue One in the Sweet 16. But that was the idea. We just so I learned a lot about what he was into and how much he holds like sentimental. It was almost like the sentiment of, I asked him why that Shark Boy and Lava Girl, which is the worst movie I've ever seen in my life, and he says because it's the first movie he's ever seen. So it's like he had like this affinity and affection for the movie. So anyway, we did that. We did stuffed animals. We pulled out all the old stuffed animals he's accrued over the years, and we did the tournament. We did stories to see what story we were going to read. So we did 64 stories. I have lived the March Madness tournament. I know everything about brackets, the 4, the 13, the 3, the 14. What do you want? 6 and 11, 5 and 12.
I think somehow your son's movie bracket has more teams remaining than I do in my real NCAA tournament bracket.
I had Villanova going all the way. And I realized, too, it's funny because so did he. I guess the teacher had him do a bracket, and he got really kind of, like, strangely, surfacely upset. You know, when Villanova lost.
Wow.
Because he was like, oh, my bracket. And I'm like, yeah, welcome to the world of March Madness. Like, your guy never wins.
Yeah.
Like, it's the one thing I'm never good at are these brackets. I just pick whoever I've seen one game of all year. And we'll talk about Northwestern a little bit later. So, Jay, it's the download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got an outstanding show lined up tonight. It's live studio 435 tonight. Ezra Furman, singer-songwriter. I mean, this is about one of the bigger names that we've had on the show. He played all things Lollapalooza. He's going to play Coachella coming up. And he is in studio to perform live. How great is that? Ezra Furman right here from right outside the city, Evanston-Skokie area. So it's exciting to talk to him. How about that, huh? That's cool. Also tonight, David Auburn's on the show, the Pulitzer Prize-winning, Tony Award-winning playwright. Wrote the play Proof, which was a Broadway smash. Also, The Homecoming with John Lithgow. The Columnist with John Lithgow. The Columnist is making its Chicago premiere at the American Blues Theater this month. It's on stage till April 9th. So David Auburn's going to join us at the big table. How cool is that? Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling coming up after 7:30. We're going to get into what happened on Capitol Hill today. I have a feeling it's going to be a lot of fireworks. Fireworks by Katy Perry was also one of the songs that got bounced in the first round. It was a low seed. You know, it's older. The innovation manager for Goose Island is going to join us. We'll talk about making new beer and keeping up with the competition when suddenly you're the big guy on the block. Goose Island, of course, has bought by Budweiser, has done so much and grown so big. But it once was the craft beer that you see in the different bars here in the hipster areas of Chicago. It's grown past that. We'll talk with Mike Siegel, the innovation manager, about how they keep up with demand, competition, come up with new beers, things like that. And Webster X, hip-hop star from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, putting Milwaukee on the hip-hop map. He's going to be at Metro on Friday. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier, Esmeralda Leon, production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11. Let's get this show started. We'll do the carryout. This is where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Big day on the old Capitol Hill. The House Intelligence Committee held hearings on whether or not Russia influenced the election, whether or not President Obama wiretapped Trump Tower, and whether or not congressmen could keep their allotted speaking time. Big news. FBI Director James Comey said they're investigating Trump and his team for colluding with Russia, and that there's no evidence in the Justice Department or in the FBI that the President Obama wiretapped. Also, Russia didn't actually manipulate voting machines, which I don't think was ever in question, but thanks for clearing that up. If House intelligence hearings aren't your thing, can I interest you in a lovely Senate judiciary hearing on the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch? Huh? It's really nice. I don't know about you, but do I really want one of the judges that will determine the future of our country to be named Neil? That's a great name for a roommate or maybe a math professor, but judge? I like a James or maybe a Wilbur or a Rose. Neil. Anyway, back to the hearings. It wouldn't be a hearing without controversy. A former student says that Gorsuch had some lectures that were pretty misogynistic where he said it was permissible for employers to ask women in job interviews that they were planning to get pregnant as to decide if they should get the job. Not sure that's Clarence Thomas level of controversy, but we'll see if it sticks. Also, Democrats still mad about Merrick Garland snub, so we'll see. President Trump tweeted all morning just to get us ready for all the action. Then he did a rally in Louisville to tell Kentucky residents about their history and asked them to remember that moment in American history when, well, he won the election. Such a beautiful day. You remember that day? That's what he said. What? 2020, just 4 years away. His approval ratings are the worst in American history at this point in the presidency, but who cares? We knew that going in. Listen, Trump's like a Todd Frazier. He's going to strike out a ton, right? He's going to hit like 200. But he's also maybe going to hit 30 home runs. And he'll be traded by the deadline when the country's under 500. Make sense? I think so. Might have mixed that metaphor up a bit. Trump got caught in a little bit of a lie this weekend. The White House said he was going to Mar-a-Lago to do some business. Serious business. Just more comfortable at a golf course. Doing business. Top secret business. But then someone tweeted out a picture and he was in golf clothes with a golf glove on. No biggie, not at all. It's really not a biggie, but why do they have to lie about it? Just tell us you're going golfing and take the lumps from the press that you golf too much or more than the last president who you attacked for golfing too much. Just take that. Don't lie, right? That's the problem here. Local, a man was shot 6 times when entering a courtroom at 26 in California this week, and this after a man was recently shot leaving 26 in Cal. So 2 takeaways, respect for the judiciary and police is waning, and also do your best to stay away from 26 and Cal, right? I mean, it used to be a mark on your record, but now it's a mark on your record.
Yikes.
Going in there for a traffic stop, you don't know what you're going to get. State Senator Daniel Biss threw his hat in the gubernatorial ring today. He's going to run for governor on the Democratic ticket, but I'm confused. Last I checked, Biss wasn't a millionaire or a billionaire, and I thought that was a prereq for running for state office. Isn't that in the state constitution? Is it? I've never read it. I don't know. I'll be honest with you. Maybe it is. I'm not sure. In weather, nice little thunderstorm last night, huh? Didn't even know it was coming through. Woke up to some hail, some thunder and lightning. Strong. But I don't have a dog. Guessing people with a dog, not so strong. In sports, we was robbed, huh? What a chaotic end to the Cats' magical run this season. An obvious blown call, a technical foul that wouldn't have been called if they didn't blow the obvious call. And a 4-point swing did the Cats in the second round loss to Gonzaga. But what a run. What a season. At the end of the broadcast, the CBS folks said the Cats are definitely going to be the favorite to win the Big Ten next year. What? Let that sink in. What? All right. Again, though, I'm not trying to be a homer, but bad officiating all game made it really hard for the good guys to win. I said it. I'll expect a fine. Go ahead. I'll take the fine. The Illini made quick work in finding a head coach to replace John Gross. Is it Gross or Grossy? Gross. Yeah. Anyway, how quick we forget. Brad Underwood comes in one after 1 year stint at Oklahoma State. Underwood, no relation to Kerry. Well, I don't think. I didn't look it up, but it could be. I mean, sure. Why not? It's probable. Kerry Underwood's dad has a great track record, and basketball insiders love the move. Nice to get a coach from a big program, but also not so nice that the dude jumped after 1 year. What happens after next year when another school comes a-calling? Now we could take all our attention and put it on the Chicago Blackhawks, who are just en fuego right now. 5 goals in the third period last night. What? With the win over the Avalanche, the Hawks clinched a playoff spot, but more importantly, they have widened their lead in the West. Right now, they have a 7-point lead over the slumping Wild. Not so wild at this point. I'd say farm-raised. The Minnesota farm-raised. The only worry for the Hawks at this point is whether or not they're peaking too early. Right. Okay. Next. Right? Give me a break. Also, this is interesting. The Cleveland Cavaliers upset the league office by sitting LeBron, Kyrie Irving, and Kevin Love on Saturday night for a primetime game on ABC. The week before, the Golden State Warriors, did the same thing. Seems to me that the teams have some issues with playing on network TV. I mean, maybe these guys only play for basic cable, right? They don't do free TV. You don't get LeBron on free TV. You got to buy a package to get LeBron. And finally tonight, Beauty and the Beast destroyed the box office, and reports are saying that all the hoopla over the gay characters, i.e. the dinnerware, was overblown. It just goes to show you 2017 America is ready for an effeminate candlestick and a coffee cup. Hollywood's taking note, too. The next movie up, a reboot of Milk. Yep, with saucers and bowls. The whole thing. That's the carryout for March 20th, 2017. It's a great night tonight, so we're feeling generous. We're going to give you 2 bags, double bag your order, paper with plastic over it. Yeah, you're welcome. All right, coming up, Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling. Touche! A lot to talk about today, so we'll get right to it. It's Download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
That.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
It's time for Touché here Monday night on 720 WGN. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio. Big day on Capitol Hill. Let you know, I think we just start by just randomly picking some of the random hearings that happened in the Senate and the House. I mean, there's many. You know, just go to the schedule. Why don't we just go ahead?
You want to go for like the
out?
House transportation hearing on the gas mileage?
There was gas mileage today. Yeah. There might have been something. Why don't we start in the House today? The long-awaited live broadcast of the House Intelligence Committee.
I'm working on my side.
not a great day for the Trump administration, as most of the intelligence, I guess, the people in charge of the intelligence agencies in our country came out and said there's nothing that says that the Trump Tower was wiretapped. And on top of it, we are currently investigating collusion between the Trump campaign at the time and Russia.
Yeah, I mean, not such a great day. I think that, first of all, I don't understand what it is with this White House. They fail to respect Rule 1 of crisis. And Roebling and I are from different sides of the aisle, but we'll both agree that Rule 1 of crisis concede the obvious. Barack Obama did not.
Telling the truth.
Well, that too. Barack Obama did not wiretap Donald Trump under any stretch of the word wiretap. And Comey said that today, and Roger said that today. And it's like, they won't give up the ghost. Sean Spicer at his press conference is like, well, this is just chapter one of a long book. And they're like, no, there's zero there.
Yeah, but there's zero there on the Russian collusion story.
No, there's not.
Evidence. Hold on. There is no evidence. No evidence was adduced. No evidence was introduced. No evidence has been identified. There's nothing there yet. Okay, there's a lot of smoke. The only law that we know, the only crime we know took place was identifying Flynn, who was a lost soul in his own right. But he still shouldn't have been identified. But that doesn't matter to the high-level Obama administration people who are still angry that Hillary had screwed
it
up.
So you say the only crime is the leak. That's what you're saying.
The crime we know took place, we know somebody who had access to that name. And to have access to that name, you're in the top dozen or so, maybe a couple.
Ding, ding,
of dozen.
Ding! Kitty Kurth guessed correct. The what was be Roebling's defense of the indefensible today?
No,
thank
I mean
you
there's
much.
No defense of the indefensible.
Chris, there's lots of evidence
attacking.
Of collusion.
There's no
lots
evidence
of evidence of collusion.
You
Roger
have
Stone. Yes, I do.
You have none.
If you stop talking, you'll hear it. Roger Stone, Donald Trump's best buddy, who called out what was going to happen before it happened from WikiLeaks with the Podesta stuff. It turns out he had 16 different conversations with the Russian hacker Guccifer 2.0. Number one.
That doesn't
number
mean
two,
anything.
Excuse me. Number one. Number two.
That's not collusion.
Number two, we know for a fact now that Donald Trump's people fought to change the Republican platform to take out the part about military defense of Ukraine.
They strengthened.
That's number two. And this is after they lied about it.
This is
this
the
is
lie.
After they
the
lied
lie is
about
coming
it.
From David right now.
That's number two. Number three, Flynn, who Sean Spicer just today described, well, he was a volunteer. I mean, the lies coming out of this White House, he described Sean Spicer as Sean Spicer described Flynn as a volunteer. Wait, one more thing.
Okay, one more thing.
And he described Manafort. He described Manafort. It said he had a limited role for a limited period of time.
Right,
these guys are digging
so deep.
Well,
so
you were asking why that happens, and I have the answer. But go ahead. They're incompetent.
Okay,
that's it.
I mean, look,
you're saying they're incompetent.
I believe that
they're not criminal.
Reince
Priebus
has failed and needs to be replaced. I believe that the White House is not functioning properly. I believe that problem starts with Trump. I believe that Trump has an unstable personality. I was not a supporter of Trump. And I said, when you get a guy like this into office, no one in the entire world, and that includes Lucretia, Ivanka Trump, his daughter. You don't get the Lucretia thing.
I don't get it. No.
Well, someday you're going to figure that one out. But anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure your listeners, somebody's going to text it. The reference.
Somebody, tell me who texts it fastest. Anyway, so Lucretia.
Yeah,
I'm
we were
sorry,
on Patty's show. They give a
no
little
one,
gift certificate
including,
for that.
Including Donald Trump Jr., including Ivana, the former wife, right? No one knows what you're going to get, except we all know we're going to get stuff that we don't like. And so here he has this great speech, and then he goes and he walks on his story, and he walks on his story by, I agree with David, there is no evidence that Barack Obama personally ordered a wiretap, which would have been illegal, blah, 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 and, you know, Watergate and all that kind of stuff. But there's no evidence of that, and I don't think, and it's ridiculous for Sean Spicer. The only reason Sean Spicer's down there doing triple backflips with a turn, full turning backflip, is because he's got a boss who's out there saying this crazy stuff?
So, but what
else do you need to know?
But the problem is, but the Russia stuff,
that's
you know,
totally bogus. And just remember, just write it down. Will you mark this tape? What day is today? The 21st?
The 20th.
All right, David has nothing else to talk about. They're afraid of talking about.
Oh no,
cutting taxes,
I'd be happy to talk about the healthcare disaster. We could talk about the healthcare debacle. We could talk about the budget debacle. There's so many debacles to talk about.
Talk about
Donald Trump has a 37% approval rating in Gallup. Barack Obama, for all of the problems he had for 8 years, never achieved 37%.
I agree. Look, Trump has got to be mindful of this stuff. I mean, you cannot go to Kentucky or you can't go off to some hangar in Orlando and solve the world's problems because there are 15,000 people who are going to wait out in the sun to come in and say, hey, I love Trump. That's not governing.
Are you at all concerned when the FBI director says, yes, we are currently investigating the collusion between the...
No, he didn't say that. The possibility of collusion. He didn't say
the possibility
the collusion.
Of collusion.
Yeah. Right.
Are you at all concerned as a Republican that that's more than being comfortable in the idea that, you know, you don't like your presidential.
Look. Manafort, if anybody in Washington doesn't know who and what Paul is, I've known him for 37 years. Okay? You don't know who and what Paul is, who and what Roger Stone is, who and what their crowd are. You have no business in this business.
Who and what are their crowd? Chris?
I'm talking about all of the, they've got a bunch of factotas sitting around in Washington or in New York or in Kiev, there are folks out there who have been sort of slithering along. They're the pilot fish who swim next to the big sharks, right? And these guys get their piece. And if you don't know that, you've got no business being in this business. So I never liked Paul Manafort, and I said that back then.
Yeah.
And I said, campaigning as an outsider,
strange
he put the campaign into the hands of the ultimate insider.
But here's where we are in the scandal, because
there is
Chris,
you have no evidence.
Yeah, no, I have lots and lots and lots of evidence. What I don't have
let me get the FBI number.
What I don't have yet is the smoking gun. Jeez. Where I feel like it's during the Watergate. When they discovered that the White House counsel's name was in the Watergate burglar's address book,
that did not happen. Howard Hunt was not the White House counsel.
Okay, semantics. Go ahead.
Yes.
White House counsel.
I'm sorry. When Howard Hunt's name was discovered,
a consultant.
Yes. When Howard Hunt, who worked at the White House. His name was found in the Watergate burglar. It's like, well, there's no evidence that Haldeman and Ehrlichman and the president were involved in a cover-up. There was just a lot of smoke. We are at a place with this Russia story where there's an astonishing amount of smoke. I mean, this is the Roger Stone. I mean, you cannot underestimate this Roger Stone business. 16 different contacts he had with the Russian hacker.
Do you know through Twitter?
Do you understand what collusion means?
Hold on a second. David, there's a thing called social media. And you know what? I actually get personal messages from people I've never met.
I have a piece of advice for you, Chris.
It's really amazing.
Don't wrap your reputation around this one, because you're going to lose it.
Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio. It's Monday night. We're doing Touche. Come back. We'll talk about the Gorsuch hearing in the other chamber today. So everybody, stay
and
with us.
We're talking about healthcare.
We'll talk healthcare too.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche. You go
right. Touche. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio.
I'm saying goodbye to Chuck Berry.
There you go.
Barris.
That was
Berry and Barris. They both died.
He was a master.
He was.
He played at my college campus.
Chuck Berry did?
Chuck Berry, yeah. Not Chuck Barris.
No. I've got a friend, John Timmerman, who's a great jazz saxophonist, has been for 40 years. And John Timmerman said that he could never get this kind of riff right on the saxophone. And he was listening to Chuck Berry, and he listened to Chuck Berry play one of his two-string licks or whatever that was. And he actually heard how Chuck Berry did that. And he was able to hear the notes, which I don't know if you guys are musicians. I can't tell one note from another. And it unlocked the whole thing for him.
Wow.
It unlocked the whole thing for him.
It's really great to see how many musicians, you know, working successful musicians are paying tribute to their career to
Berry.
Well, it all started with Chuck Berry.
Keith Richards.
Yeah. Well, and Carl Perkins.
Oh, my God.
All right, let's get back to politics.
Oh, yeah, that.
Let's do that. Let's talk about the first sort of foray into the nomination process for Judge Neil Gorsuch.
Yeah.
Today was a big day to start it off. Does it seem like it's going to be contentious, Chris? Is going to be smooth sailing?
I got to tell you, quick plug, love the WGN Morning News. They got top rated today, which is very nice.
Absolutely.
But about a month ago on GN, I went on with Marge Halpern, my friend of all of ours, and I said the only two questions are, how much will the Democrats, with this Gorsuch nomination, I said, A, how much will the Democrats hurt themselves, and how much will they hurt the Senate? And I think that's absolutely charting the course. I mean, there are a few left-wingers, but basically, Gorsuch is so Hollywood central casting for a Supreme Court justice, so conscientious and deliberative, there is no reason to oppose him. The Democrats might choose to hurt themselves, and if they choose to go for the filibuster, they'll only hurt the Senate.
Well, two words, Merrick Garland. I mean, a lot of voters, liberal voters, Democrat voters, they want to hold their senators to the idea that they need to resist in a way because of what happened to Merrick Garland.
No, I agree. It's not going to happen, unfortunately. What is troublesome is that. You know, and Donald Trump is smart in this. Yes, Gorsuch looks the part.
Yes, Gorsuch has a very nice manner and a self-effacing manner, and he loves his kids and his dogs.
He's a successful judge,
and all of that stuff. He also always takes the corporation side over the individual
side.
He takes
He
takes the executive over the individuals, and even the regulators who used to get deference no longer get deference under Gorsuch. This guy is a reactionary, and should he get on the court, he will be viewed as to the right of Antonin.
So David is.
He probably will be viewed as the most right wing member of this court if he's confirmed.
David is trying.
Do you agree with that?
Absolutely not. I think that Gorsuch is both an originalist and a textualist, but he has had
nonsense and non-censor.
He's had the time and as you know, Scalia really blazed that trail, and he's one of these guys who got to scoot along the trail because Scalia blazed it, and I think he's going to go significantly farther. And David, on the Chevron doctrine, which is deference to regulators, Gorsuch has enunciated something very profound, and that is that when Congress is ambiguous, it's a judicial rule, the Chevron doctrine, that the judiciary will defer to the administrative agency that is interpreting the law. Okay, who in our basic third grade understanding of civics is there to interpret the law? Is it the executive, or is it the legislative, or is it the judicial branch?
Well,
answer,
as a matter of fact,
the judicial branch.
As a matter of fact, it's the executive and the administrative that takes the laws and promulgates regulations to enforce the laws. That is their job. And as you said, the Chevron doctrine historically gives deference to that. Gorsuch says, well, it depends. And that's why all this nonsense about textualists and originalists, it's all a bunch of hooey. And we
it's
all
not,
saw that.
Not. David is
we all saw
over.
That. No, I'm not.
No,
we
not
all saw that in Bush.
He's not addressing
I'm
the
addressing
issue.
It exactly.
No,
you just
not.
Keep interrupting me.
You're failing.
Yeah, it's spicy. Lion spicy.
You're failing anyway. Because here's why you're failing. Chevron is based on the ambiguity of the congressional act, David. It is not based on the
It's what you define as the ambiguity of the congressional act in order for you to overrule their regulations in order to benefit the corporate interest.
No,
this is exactly how Gorsuch has ruled again and again.
Well, no, you're wrong about
there is legitimate reason for Democrats to oppose this nomination having nothing to do with Merrick Garland.
Right. Well, that's interesting.
I think there are
Would
ideological.
You that? Would you accept
there are
that?
Ideological reasons. If I was in David's shoes, ideologically, where you have such little else, of course you would try.
Yes, because how dare we deal with principle and matters of law and protecting people instead of corporations?
Right, really? No.
Whereas
I
the Republicans,
about,
like Chris,
on.
Only want to help the corporations and the corporate interests.
No.
Talk,
I
legal
talk. About,
geez, even now I'm feeling like Bernie Sanders.
What about the money?
It's all about Wall Street. It's the billionaires and the millionaires. I left Chris speechless.
What about the Muslim prisoner who was denied what the law entitled him to? That is a clear case, and there are many, many like them, where Gorsuch said, I don't care what the executive thinks. I don't care what the executive says. The executive, in the form of the prison warden, has failed to uphold the statutory rights of this individual, which in fact were also constitutional.
Well, which is why Chris is going to support the Ninth Circuit when they overturn the Muslim ban for a second time. Oh, wait, no, you won't, because it's ideologically inconvenient for you.
All right,
no,
Gorsuch,
it's not a Muslim ban.
We've got lots of time to talk about Gorsuch. It's not going to be until mid-April till this thing gets confirmed.
Healthcare.
But we're
quickly, because I only have
out.
A minute here, guys. And healthcare, the vote's going to be this week. What do we think? I mean, do you see it coming out of the House in its form that it's in right now?
This is an indefensible bill that Chris is about to defend. 24 million people are going to be thrown out of their health care.
Wrong. You are wrong. That is
thrown
false.
Off of insurance. It's not.
No.
It's
no,
CBO.
The 24 million people. CBO got the original estimate 100% wrong.
No, they did
not.
And
what you're talking about here is not
no,
people,
they did not.
Excuse me. Not people thrown off, people who are never going
to
get
You're
on.
Not entitled to your own facts, Chris. You're just not. The CBO projected that the uninsured rate would drop below 11%, and it did.
We're going to have to wrap up right there.
On absolute numbers, facts. They were 100% wrong.
Chris Rowling, Dave Lundy, every Monday
touché.
Night. Touche. All right. Wow. That was a... explosive touche. It's all over the room.
I felt it all the way up here. I'm seven floors up.
How are you, Rob?
You know, I listened to your, well, like I do every night, your takeout, which was good as always. And one thought occurred to me that NBA players' lives matter.
Right.
You know?
It's amazing. Something's going on that they're not doing a good enough job investigating. It seems to me LeBron James, who's what, the head of the players union or one of the.
He's a rep. I know
he's
that.
He's a rep.
I mean,
but he's one of the most influential guys in the NBA. And of course, Steph Curry and the Golden State Warriors are the marquee team. The two games on ABC, both of them, they sit not just one guy, they sit the whole, I mean, the three stars.
Well, Popovich, the head coach of the Spurs, is notorious for doing that very thing. And I got to tell you, if I'm a network exec, I'm picking up the phone and I'm calling the NBA commissioner and saying, look, guys.
Yeah, they already did that, right?
Yeah, you know, this is ridiculous.
I don't know. It's got something. I know they want to act like, no, it's the game. But I'm like, then sit them on the front end of a back-to-back. Like the Cavaliers had a back-to-back Friday and Saturday. So they were saying, well, you know, they shouldn't have scheduled that for a primetime game. But it seems to me this is beyond what we as fans expect, and this has something to do with revenue share or exposure or bad contract or something, where these players are essentially saying enough is enough, and we are stuck holding a bag watching J.R. Smith.
I'm sorry, a bad contract? How much does LeBron James make a year?
I'd love to ask these guys. Like, I'd love for someone to be honest about it, because when you talk to them, they go, oh, it's just, you know, we got to have rest. It's rest. These guys need rest. You're like, really? Okay. On a Saturday, you imagine they did that. The Bulls back in the day did that. Jordan, Pippen, and Rodman all sat on a Saturday night game against the Knicks or the Utah Jazz or something. They just wouldn't do that.
Joe Dumars never sat. Bill Laimbeer never sat.
That's right. I don't know
Spider
what's happening.
Sally never sat.
Something's happening there, and they're not able to figure it out. They're cracking the case on that one yet. We'll see what happens.
All I know is that on the good news side of things, 34 seconds, 3 goals, the Blackhawks are flying.
Unbelievable, man. Just unbelievable.
Yeah, a lot of fun to watch.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my guest tonight at the big table is a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright who won the Tony Award for Best Play. That play was Proof, and the playwright is David Auburn. Auburn was born here in Chicago, and after heading to New York, found himself with huge success relatively early. Proof was only his second play. The drama set here in Chicago about a woman who spends her life taking care of her mentally ill mathematician father was a huge hit on Broadway. Auburn has continued his success with works on stage and on screen. His play, The Columnist, starring John Lithgow, was a hit back in 2012. The play was about the life of the legendary newspaper columnist Joseph Alsop, and it looked at power, influence, and the Fourth Estate, and it couldn't be more relevant today in 2017. David's in town because The Columnist is on stage. It's Chicago premiere at the American Blues Theater. It got great reviews, and it is on stage 773 through April 1st. David Auburn, welcome to The Download.
Thanks a lot.
It's great to have you here. Talk about this play. This is an interesting time to redo The Columnist.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated with the way that you went about putting this play together. And talk about where it came from, because it really is a history lesson all in itself.
Yeah, it came from a number of different places. As you said, it's about Joseph Alsop, who is sort of forgotten now, but in the mid part of the 20th century, he was one of the biggest journalists, most important, most influential columnists in the country. I had never heard of him. I started reading about the Vietnam War a few years back just because I felt that it was an area that I didn't know a lot about. I wanted to try to educate myself a little bit. And the name of Joe Alsop and of his brother, Stuart Alsop, they wrote together for many years, kept popping up in all these interesting places. It was sort of Zelig-like that they seemed to be these people who were connected to everyone, who were on the scene at key events.
Classic Washington insider columnists.
Very much so, and behind the scenes. And, in an era when things operated differently than they do today, so that he would go to the White House and have drinks with Kennedy regularly. They were close friends. He himself was a cousin of FDR. So he had these sort of deep roots in the old DC aristocracy, and he guarded that territory very jealously. And the drama comes in the 60s and in the Vietnam era, because his influence starts to fall apart, and particularly around Vietnam. He's very pro-Vietnam. He's very hawkish. And as that war begins to...
It falls out of favor, that concept, right?
Very much so. And he sort of comes out of step with the times. And at the same time, there's a personal drama going on, which is that Joe is gay in an era when you had to remain closeted. He's married to a very prominent socialite called Susan Mary. And he's been living for 10 or 15 years with a secret, which is that in the 50s, while on a trip to the Soviet Union, he was set up and blackmailed. He was photographed in his hotel room having sex with a young guy who it turned out was planted there to entrap him. So his whole professional life in the 50s and 60s, he's operating under the under the cloud that and he knows that at any moment he could be blackmailed by the Soviets. So questions about his loyalty, questions about where his how much his political opinions are influenced by the pressure he's under in his personal life are very prominent in the play.
It's I mean it's tremendous to think about the things that have happened in this country in 2016, 2017 and how history repeats itself, or just the idea that there are so many different things that we, in the play, the influence and involvement in scandal and blackmail and possible blackmail, Russian blackmail. It's tremendous to think almost the idea life imitates art, imitates life, imitates art again.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I mean, when we did the play originally in 2011, 2012, it was an interesting story, but it was a Cold War story. And it was, you know, it seemed like it belonged to the past. It was sort of like this little piece of history. And now it's come back again. And I never would have imagined that only 5 or 6 years later, you know, the Russian influence, all of those questions would be swirling around us again. But here we are.
I mean, finding out about the historical nature of Joe Alsop and all the things that you find, that's great. And it's a great research project, you know, for anybody who wants to learn about our history. What makes it a great play? What about his story? What do you tie together to make the columnist come alive beyond just sort of a biopic or a stage bio of his life?
I think that what I ended up focusing on is the fall. You know, here's this guy who on Inauguration Eve, when Kennedy was inaugurated, after the inauguration, Kennedy went to Alsop's house to have a celebratory drink. That was where he chose to go when all the balls had closed. And Alsop had the ear of the president. He was at the pinnacle. And really only about, you know, 7, 8 years later, he was a laughingstock in Washington, partially because he had become so unhinged on the subject of Vietnam and the communist menace.
Holding on tight to what he had, trying so hard to hold on to that influence and that power and that prestige and the fact that he was the center of everybody's attention as he fell out of favor.
Exactly. And he wasn't blind. I mean, he understood what was happening. He saw very clearly that a new generation of journalists, a new generation of readers were coming along who didn't want to hear anything he had to say. In fact, thought he was ridiculous. So what really interested me was that question of why does that happen? Why does someone cling so tightly to a set of beliefs, even in the face of their own self-destruction? And that's kind of the center of the play, I think.
It's so revealing. And you think about not only, you know, how that relates to today and some of the stuff we just talked about, but as we talk about a little bit more of a microscope on the media and columnists and others that have sources in the White House and don't have sources and President Trump coming out and saying the enemy of the people, the media is the enemy of the people, it puts it in a different light. You think about how the media used to be and how it interacted with politics.
Yeah. In Alsop's era, there really were maybe 3 or 4 or 5 nationally syndicated columnists who everyone who was anyone read, and the terms of the discussion, the sort of scope of the national discussion was very much set by those people. That's changed a lot. I mean, we have a much more democratized media to the point where a guy who just a few years ago who was running essentially a fringe, you know, right-wing website is now sitting in the White House. So the gates are sort of open, and there are good things about that. And one of the things that happens in the play is that Joe is fighting hard against the new generation of journalists like David Halberstam, who are coming up, going to Vietnam, saying, this is not going well. This is not going the way you're being told it's going. And also just raging against these young kids who he sees as not having the authority and not having the experience. They shouldn't be allowed to make those kind of judgments. They shouldn't be allowed to talk to the public.
Right, right.
People like Joe should be allowed to talk to the public. So, you know, that question of who owns the truth.
Who tells the stories, right?
Yeah. And you know, you hear that with Trump today, that a large part of what he's saying when he comes before the public is the truth can only come from me. The only things that you can believe are the things that I say. And that effort to sort of control what the truth is perennial. I mean, all public officials, all people in power try to do it.
David Auburn's my guest tonight. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. His play, The Columnist, which was done in 2012, starring John Lithgow, is on stage at the American Blues Theater. It's Chicago premiere here in 2017. Couldn't be more relevant today. It is at Stage 773 through April 1st. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. More with David Auburn here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio at the big table, David Auburn, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, won the Tony for Best Play for his work Proof, which was turned into a movie. I mean, still considered one of the best dramas Broadway's ever seen, and it gets done around the country over and over and over. It's such a great play. The Columnist, another one of his great plays, which was on Broadway in 2012, is getting its Chicago premiere right now at the American Blues Theater, which is going on stage at Stage 773 through April 1st. You were born here in Chicago, and you came back to Chicago for school. How often do you get back? What's your thought on this town? Do you own part of this town?
I would like to think of myself as a Chicago playwright, even though I probably, I'm not really allowed to do that. But when I was telling my wife, whenever I come here, I feel like I'm home. This is the city where I feel most at home, even though it's not the city where I've lived the longest. The last time I spent a stretch of time here was last year. I directed Long Day's Journey down in Hyde Park, right. It was great to be here for an extended period of time, 5 or 6 weeks. I love to come back, as often as I can.
I mean, obviously, people who've seen Proof know that that's a story. That's Chicago's in its blood. That's, it's a university. Talk about that. Talk about the idea of setting that play in Chicago and using Chicago in your work.
It wasn't originally set in Chicago. When I wrote the first draft, which was a very kind of sketchy draft, I had the story. I had the characters. And I remember thinking, this feels a little unspecific. It feels like it needs to be grounded somewhere. So I set it in it was set in a university community. So I set it in the one that I knew, which was the University of Chicago. And that ended up feeling right for more reasons than I expected. I mean, in that play, there's a dad who's kind of fallen off the tracks. He was an academic star, and now he's still sort of haunting the bookstores and walking around the coffee shops. And we used to see those kinds of people at UC. I mean, it was a place where you would have these sort of legendary figures who were now kind of ghosts.
They're kind of retired, and they're like, I've got my routine. This is where I go, and I go to the coffee shop, and then I go back to my house in Hyde Park.
Exactly. I mean, we'd see Saul Bellow sort of skulking around the campus, and sometimes there would be legends accruing to these people that they were these extraordinary geniuses who burned out young and things like that. So the kind of melancholy romance that I associated with that academic environment ended up finding its way into the play.
It's interesting because you talk about only being born here and going to school here, but it's tremendous to think that you had such success with just your second play. Was it the kind of thing that when you talk about the evolution of Proof and you talk about the sketching out the first draft, where were you in your career? I mean, you're just on your first play. You're going on your second. It must at that time in your life, there's no way you could assume that you were going to get a Pulitzer Prize for the work that you were doing.
No, I thought that I would probably end up producing that play myself. I mean, I had had one other play done professionally off Broadway. It was fine. It wasn't particularly successful. It had made me want to keep going. I knew I loved working in the theater. I had this kind of do-it-yourself theory that's essentially what you do when you part of that came from Chicago.
I was going to say that's the ethos here in town.
Yeah, you get your friends together and you put on shows. And I thought, all right, maybe I can get a theater to do Proof, and maybe if I can't, we'll produce it ourselves. And ended up getting done on this very surprisingly large scale and having a long life, but it was certainly nothing that I ever expected.
How do you bring that DIY aesthetic to your work? When you are, the playwright of a show on Broadway, is it sort of the little victories to be the playwright, to work with some of the people? I mean, talk about how you use that spirit when you're at such a high level.
It's still about having a group of friends who you trust and who, when you have a new draft or something, you can invite them over and give them drinks and make them sit in your living room and listen to the thing that you just wrote and trust that they will tell you, I don't think this is the one, or that they'll say, I really like this, or they'll say, this was really interesting up until this point, and then this is where I got confused. You hope for an honest response, and And the people who do that for me are basically the same people that I've had around me since college and since early in my career.
And that's you have to keep that, because otherwise, especially as you get more and more fame and you're able to, you know, you're winning Pulitzer Prize. If you have people around you that don't know your work or whatever, they're going to be like, bravo. They're not going to give it to you straight.
You know, the standards are always high. And when you have a play and you go into rehearsal, no matter who you are, the actors are going to ask you tough questions and the director is going to ask you tough questions. And the thing has to work. I mean, it's a machine that has to function, and if it doesn't, you've got to fix it, because otherwise a lot of people are left floundering. So no matter how many people are telling you it's terrific, which doesn't happen all the time, I hasten to say, there's the thing is put to the test of the rehearsal room. And that's you always want to be prepared when you go in there.
How much as a playwright are you involved in the production of a Broadway play? When I think about Proof, I mean, is it the kind of thing that you're writing up to the moment, you're continually changing? Or is it more like Hollywood, where you submit a script and you get a paycheck and they say, thanks, we'll take it from here?
It's kind of the opposite of Hollywood, which is why you do it, you know, which is why you do it, even though very often the money is not anything like Hollywood. You always own your play as a playwright. You never sell it to anyone. You always own the copyright. The theater is licensing the right to produce it. And there are lots of traditions that are sort of built in to the way the theater works, which are very precious to a playwright. Things like you can always veto casting. You always have a voice in the casting.
Really?
I remember being really struck when I did Proof, which was the first time I was working with really a kind of superstar director, Daniel Sullivan, who was, you know, as big and still is as big as any director on Broadway. And he still consulted me and wanted to make sure that I was happy with all the choices he was making. And, you know, I think he did that not because he respected me particularly. He didn't really know me, but I mean, I hope he does now, but because that's how you do it
right.
In the theater.
He's trying to suss out your vision, what you wanted from the words that you put on the page.
Exactly. And so, you know, when you're working at any level in the theater, the playwright is around, the playwright is consulting and giving approvals to choices that are made.
David Auburn's my guest. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, Tony Award-winning playwright as well, Proof. The Columnist is making a Chicago premiere at the American Blues Theater. It's on stage right now through April 1st at Stage 773. Let's take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. We'll continue with David Auburn. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, David Auburn, the playwright, Pulitzer Prize winner, Tony Award winning. He has had a tremendous career, not only with Proof, which won several awards, but The Columnist, which was on Broadway in 2012, is making its Chicago premiere. The American Blues Theater is putting it up at Stage 773. It's running through April 1st. The Columnist is somewhat of a departure for you in the way that it's historical. It's nonfiction. I mean, obviously it's a play, it's fiction, but the concept of taking a story, a real story, finding out more about this columnist and putting it on stage, is that difficult for you? Talk about how you bring a character to life that actually lived.
He had a very distinctive voice, Joseph Alsop. Not just the voice on the page, but his literal voice.
Right.
I mean, he had such a remarkably affected New England, Harvard, WASP accent that people at the time commented on it. We've listened to recordings of Joe. There's a fantastic recording that people can find online of a phone call that Alsop made to LBJ right after the Kennedy assassination. And he's sort of lecturing him about how to handle the Warren Commission. And LBJ can't get a word in edgewise. You know, even Lyndon Johnson can't get a word in against Joe Alsop. So you had this big personality, and the task was to sort of figure out a way to bring that out. And what I ended up doing in the play was contrasting him with various foils. So he comes up against his brother, who's much more sort of even-keeled, level-headed, philosophically conservative than he is, doesn't believe in rocking the boat nearly as much. He comes up against his wife, who is in love with him and is struggling to understand what kind of life they're going to have together. He comes up against David Halberstam, who mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier, who's the young Turk,
right.
who thinks and in life was really distrustful of Alsup and thought that he was doing a terrible thing with the reports he was sending back from Vietnam about how well everything was going. And then there's a sort of invented character in the play who's an amalgam of a number of people who were in his life. When Joe got married, his wife had a number of children and he became a stepfather and apparently a very doting one. So there's a young woman in the play who's Joe's stepdaughter. Mm-hmm. She's called Abigail. And we kind of watch her grow up in the play. She starts off, she's about 14, and at the end of the play, she's in her 20s.
You know, for you, I think about the columnists and Proof and the other work that you've done as well. But, I mean, there always seems to be conflict in the family. There's a lot in your work about the storylines that bring and tear families apart. Is that accurate to say that's sort of like a through line through the work that you put out?
Yeah, it's a kind of gravitational system that keeps sucking me in. I mean, it's the root of so much great drama. And those conflicts between parents and children, and not only conflicts, but relationships,
right.
You know, the things that you get from your parents, the things that you don't get, the things that they need from you, all those kinds of transactions feel very central to me when I'm sitting down to write.
You've had such a career. I mean, Proof turned into a great film, I would say, 2004, 2005.
Yeah.
And that was it was interesting because, you know, you had started to create a career for you writing screenplays. I mean, you wrote the screenplay for that film. Talk about the challenges of making a transition from the stage to the screen. Because that's there. I mean, it's similar in the way that, you know, it's the constructs are similar, but there's a lot that are different. Was it a difficult transition for you?
It was. I mean, part of it was just because I was so happy with the way the play was working that by the time it came around to do the movie, I thought, do I really want to sort of try to reinvent this and turn it inside out? And you do have to kind of turn it inside out. But it ended up being a really interesting exercise. I mean, there's a mystery in the play. And in a stage play, you are in a particular place and you are not seeing certain things because they're not taking place where the play is taking place.
Right.
So there's a kind of natural tension that comes in drama from offstage, onstage, right? Sometimes in plays, the offstage characters, the ones you never see, are very powerful presences. But in a movie, there's no offstage. You know, you can go anywhere, you can do anything. So figuring out a way to keep that mystery even though we're in a more fluid medium in some ways was really challenging.
You mentioned, you know, we talked in the last segment about, you know, being able to stay with the project on Broadway or on the stage. In film, it's different. I mean, in film, they get a script from you and they say, this is awesome. Here's your check. Great handshake. We're gonna have one of our guys look at it. And we've decided to make it a Western.
Yeah.
how do you as a prolific writer, as someone who, you know, pours yourself into this work, deal with the concept of having to let go?
It can be tough. I mean, you know what you're getting into when you take an assignment, and I've done a bunch of assignments for studios. You know that, you know, you're essentially in the position of being like a contractor on a house, you know, they want you to put the roof on the building, and they want it to be a good roof and not to leak, and they're going to pay you, you know, handsomely to do that, but it's not your house. So you try to get that into your head, but it's also very hard to do the best work that you can do without a sense of investment in it. And very often by the end of the project, you do have a very strong sense of investment. So
yeah,
it can be, it can be tough when the rug inevitably is pulled out, and it almost always
is. Did you have to learn that lesson? I mean, is that something as a player? I mean, it's such success on stage. And the reason I ask is, I think, I mean, you're winning Pulitzer Prizes on stage. Do you have to learn that lesson that they just want a roof and you have to sort of go through the motion of saying, no, I want more?
Yeah, you learn it. I mean, I knew it intellectually, but you really find out once you've been talking to someone every day, twice a day, three times a day about something, and then when it is no longer your project, you're not talking to them at all. It's a whole different business, and not without its pleasures and rewards, but you keep coming back to the theater because that is the place where you can see your vision such as it is through to the end.
You've made your name in writing, but as you just mentioned, I mean, you were at the Court Theater last year directing a show. Talk about that. Talk about the idea of you know, directing and doing other things in theater besides just writing plays?
I've been lucky that I've been able to direct some classics, plays that I love and have always wanted to understand better. And I found that the only way to really feel like you're educating yourself about a great work, particularly one as big and massive as something like Long Day's Journey and Tonight, is to take it on. That's what forces you to really pull it apart and think about carefully about it and discover it, explore it. You're physically in it for
right.
2 months, 3 months. So it's an immensely rewarding experience just to learn from Eugene O'Neill or to learn from Albee when you're working on one of those plays.
You know, you've got a tremendous company in the American Blues Theater doing The Columnist. And I think it was funny because when I started to go through the research of, you know, we were doing this interview, I put proof into the old Google machine. And it's on, I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, the college kids are doing it. Everybody's doing it. I mean, think about that for a second, the idea that the play that you've written is being produced as part of, you know, someone's, like just like you just mentioned about Eugene O'Neill, the idea that someone is learning more about you and about what you were trying to say and trying to get into the words. What's that make you feel as an artist, as someone who wrote this play back in, what, 2002, 2000, probably before that, 2000, 2001? What, I mean, think about that. I mean, what does it mean to you that the play still lives on?
It means a lot to me. I mean, it's a source of continual astonishment, particularly that the scenes, partially, maybe mostly because they're good for the ages, are used in drama schools a lot. You know, these are characters who are in their early 20s, and they fit well for people who are learning their craft. So it's really nice to know that a lot of people who audition for me for other things say, I did this scene back at, you know, back at NYU.
Do they ever get in front of you and you're like, I'm gonna do a scene from Proof? You're like, please don't.
They haven't done that. It's not probably not a great idea.
Well, I mean, it's just the word. It's so interesting. Like being a playwright, the words that are on the page, there's always meaning behind it. There's ways that actors pull those words out. They interpret it. They change it. They make it theirs by you know, doing the performance. And I think about the fact that the play is being done all over, even The Columnist, but Proof as well, like are being done all over the country, all over the world. I think about all the different interpretations of the words that you put on the page, you know, 20 years ago. And that's where it's, I mean, there's an epiphany point where you're like, there's a lot of people doing your, you know, saying your words in ways that you may not have intended or right. that, you know, like, and so how do you reconcile that as a writer that you know that you could go and someone missed the point of Proof or missed the point of that scene? Because it is a play that's done all over the world.
Yeah, no, that flexibility that you're talking about, the fact that people can interpret it, is the reason you write plays in the first place. I mean, you want to see what other people are bringing to it. You know that every time it's done, it's going to be done differently. That's part of what's really fun about it. Along with that privilege is the risk that someone's really going to get it wrong or someone's going to do something very strange that you might not like. But in general, more often than not, the results are good and the results are interesting. And I like seeing things that surprise me. I'm going to see the production of The Columnist tonight. I've seen rehearsals, but I haven't seen it on stage. I know I'm going to be surprised by things. I think I'll be delighted by things. That's part of the pleasure of doing this.
You know, my last question, we've had people from Broadway on the show and actors talk about it. And they always will talk about the one part of the that never kind of gets called out is the rejection. The idea that, you know, actors can be in great plays. I mean, they'll be winning Tonys and they're still not sure what their next gig is. And I would assume that that's similar with writers in the way that you win a Pulitzer Prize for Proof. And it's up to you to perform or to produce the next work, but it's not necessarily a guarantee that anyone will produce it. How do you, as a writer, as someone who has you know, at the top of your game as a professional, how do you sort of deal with that conflict? Deal with the fact that you're always sort of inherently looking for the next gig.
Yeah, an actor that I met pretty early on who had just been in a big movie told me when I was talking to him about this that this is a nonlinear business. You know, the next thing that follows does not follow in a straight upward trajectory from the thing you did last. And if you can kind of get that idea through your head, then you'll be okay.
It's hard to get through your head, though.
It is, because you assume that things travel in straight lines.
And you're climbing. I mean, it's part of the job is to get better and climb upward.
Yeah. But, you know, all careers, even the most astounding careers, legendary careers, have many ups and downs in them. And so people with more ordinary careers like me have to expect that as well. And I think, again, it's about sort of understanding what the rules of the game are and taking whatever pleasure you can from the work that you do.
Awesome. Pulitzer Prize winning playwright, Tony Award winner, best play for Proof, David Auburn. His play, The Columnist, is on stage. The American Blues Theater show is on at Stage 773 through April 1st. David, it's a pleasure. Thanks for being here and being my guest on the big table.
Thank you.
Ooh, that's a good jam. Beats by Zim. Pete Zimmerman bringing the... Yeah, it's smooth. It's download as we carry on through the Monday, March 20th, 2017. Coming up, Mike Siegel's here. We're going to talk about Goose Island Beer. Big news that they are introducing a new beer, Wrigley Field, this year for the Cubs. But what Mike does is he's the innovation manager for Goose Island. So we'll talk a little bit about what it takes to come up with a new beer, create new work. I'm assuming... When you say brewmasters and innovators, they consider their beer art in a way, right?
For sure.
So, yeah, we'll talk about that, right? I'm excited. I mean, I love Goose Island. I find myself always around that brand. I don't know why, but I always find myself like, it's become my like default. If I'm at a bar and I'm like, someone comes up and says, what do you want to drink? And I'm like, Goose Island.
Yeah.
Right? Can't go wrong.
And you look at the taps, and you always notice the Goose tap. Yep. You know, the line of taps, it's easily recognizable. What I'm concerned about is that we go to the Cubs games, we drink Goose Island.
Yeah,
you know, they offer that Goose Island, but the vendors come around like, what do you want, green or yellow? Do they come in green cans or yellow cans? So I hope this doesn't. If they have to do three things, oh my God, what are we gonna do?
Do you want green, yellow, or fuchsia? Can I get a sampler on the fuchsia? Talk with Mike coming up here. Webster X going to join us as well. Hip-hop artist from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You don't think of the hip-hop sort of royalty. You don't think much of the hip-hop scene in Wisconsin. But there's a burgeoning, robust scene, and it's really behind this not only hip-hop artist, but I would say we call him experimentalist. Because he does a lot with art, with video, with music. He's going to be at Metro on Friday night. He's blowing up. I actually emailed a friend from Milwaukee. Like, do you know Webster X? And I'm like, hell yeah. So that's good, right? I didn't want to be in a spot where you're like, no, we don't know who this guy is. No, there is no such thing. I'd be like, I was just reading a press release. Webster X coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And then awesome live performance, Ezra Furman in studio. I'm so excited about this. He brought his guitar tonight. Ezra Furman, I mean, everything from Lollapalooza. He's got Coachella coming up. The EP in 2016, which was great. The album in 2015, which got great reviews. And then new music he's working on. We'll talk about that coming up. This week, we're off tomorrow for the Blackhawks, which is fine. Blackhawks are hot. Oh, my gosh. I love that the only thing is now the Sports Center question, are they peaking too soon? No, they're fine. Coming up on Wednesday, I'm so excited about this. Wednesday's going to be a great show. Wednesday, not only do we have Oscar award-winning director Danny Boyle in studio at the big table. I mean, Slumdog Millionaire, 127 Days, and his latest T2 Trainspotting, the sequel. How cool, man. It's awesome to have him in. And I just loved it. I saw the movie. The movie's great. It is just awesome to, in real time, have a sequel that is 20 years later. To get all the same actors back and have it be 20 years in their lives. It's great. I love that concept. It's not some, you know, sequel that they fake, like everyone's got a fake mustache. They thin their hair like in CG. Ewan McGregor looks 20 years older. You know, it's amazing. And there's some flashbacks in the movie, and you're like, wow. So for any Trainspotting fan, but also just, you know, a fan of Danny Boyle and all the stuff he does, that'll be Wednesday. Also on Wednesday, which I'm very excited about, from HBO's Crashing, Pete Holmes, comedian Pete Holmes will be on the show. And then coming up on Friday, this is a star-studded week. On Friday, Steppenwolf, ensemble member, playwright, director, actor, all-around Chicago star Tracy Letts in studio at the Big Table. So this is one of those weeks, man.
We're like, we're filled to the rim with Pulitzer Prize winners.
I know, right? And I also feel like this is kind of like, this is a week that like rivals a Stephen Colbert or rivals like a Jimmy Fallon, you know, like when they say, come on the show, Tracy Letts. Where's the same kind of thing. I feel like this is our week and there's more, you know, and for the download faithful this Friday, Steve Gadlin. He's back for his monthly check-in Friday night. So we got a lot going on this week. All right, coming up this hour, we'll talk Goose Island and hip-hop. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Big show coming up here tonight. We still got 2 hours of the Download. Looking forward to the 10 o'clock hour. Ezra Furman performing live in studio. Well, it's time now for Industry Night, our Monday night segment where we talk food and beverage. Great chefs, bartenders, club promoters, those making great product in Chicago. And, of course, that includes beer. It was just announced that Goose Island is creating a new beer for Wrigley Field. It's called 1060 Wit, and it's going to be available at the park starting this season. If you've been to Wrigley in the last couple of years, you've seen more and more Goose Island product. The Chicago company has become the granddaddy of the craft beer scene. Goose Island has cemented its place in the Chicago community, but also represents Chicago to the world with beers like 312, Goose IPA, and Bourbon County Stout. But the market's a lot tighter than it used to be with other Chicago beer companies giving chase. But Goose perseveres, partly because of their deal with Budweiser, but also because they're constantly innovating, coming up with new beers in Chicago and for the overall marketplace. In studio with me tonight, one of the men responsible for creating new brews, Mike Siegel, is the brewing R&D manager for Goose Island, and he joins me now. Mike, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's talk about 1060 Wit. I mean, for you guys, I mean, you could put 312 on tap at Wrigley Field, and I don't think people are going to notice the difference. They just are drinking beer.
Yeah, of course.
How important is it for you guys to innovate and put new product in the park?
Well, we wanted to, and we've got quite a few beers in there now, IPA, Green Line. So we just wanted to do something different, and this is exclusive beer for Wrigley Field. It's decidedly not a Cubs beer because we want the visiting fans to drink it as well. savvy there, but a collaboration with Wrigley Field to bring something new. It's going to be draft only, and something that'll be should be available around the ballpark.
What kind of beer is it?
Wit, and it's something that, you know, I kept on asking myself as far as the average, not the average craft beer drinker, but the average baseball fan going to Wrigley Field, do they know what a wit is? And it's white. It means white in Flemish. So it's Belgian beers are a huge inspiration for us, for Goose Island. So it's something that, in a wit, you know, you've got something like a Hoegaarden, would be the classic example. They're great summer drinkers. Like, what do you want to drink at the ballpark on a hot day? Right?
Yeah, you see that. And most of the time you see that represented in some of the offerings that are the craft beer offerings, like Allagash, things like that. Right. Let me ask you, I mean, is this the first foray into wits for Goose Island? I don't think of the white beer when I think of Goose Island.
No, I mean, the first in quite a long time. Given we've been around for 29 years, we've dabbled in just about everything. And but I'm coming up on 5.5 years. We haven't done a wit out of Fulton, the production brewery, the one in the near west side right by United Center. Of course, the brew pub at Clybourne is brewing a new beer every week. So. Right. They've brewed a wit.
Let me ask you. I mean, it's funny. You say 29 years, and I think of Goose Island. And let's go through a quick history lesson because this, your company, I mean, the company you work for, I think about it when I was just talking to Pete about the idea that, okay, you know, when I was younger, when I was 21 years old, Goose Island was the specialty. That was the, you would go through all the beers and be like, what's the red one down there?
Sure.
You know, It's Honker's Ale. I'll try it. And to where it is now, where you walk into a bar and they're like, "Hey, what do you want? I'll just whatever you got in Goose." I mean, talk about that the idea, the history that you guys have gone from the craft beer to really the big player on the block.
Sure, it's yeah. So Goose started in 1988. Like I said, 29 years. That was a brew pub back in a time when the beer landscape was nationally, not just in Chicago, but was basically mass lager. You know, big, you know, fizzy lager. And John Hall started the company, wanted to do, inspired by his trips to Europe, wanted to bring back, you know, English style ale. Why can't I get something that's really full flavor, an all malt beer, full flavor, maybe some hop character, or a Czech lager, or German pils. So it started there. 95 is when the production plant opened. So when I say production brewery, it's, you know, where you make, where you bottle and you keg.
Yeah,
you know,
right, right.
You're not just a brew pub anymore. You're serving your community at large. And at the time it was the only production brewery in Chicago proper, and I think until about 2007. So if you wanted to be a brewer and make a living as a brewer in the city limits, there were a couple brew pubs and then one production brewery for a very long time. But in the last 10 years, as you said, it's a lot's changed. And that's a great thing. We've had a lot of brewers go on to open up breweries,
right,
in Chicagoland area, or become a head brewer at local breweries. So it's a great opportunity for brewers. It's great for beer drinkers, you know, because first and foremost, we're beer lovers. So I like variety. When I go out, I like to go to a place. I mean, I think Greg Hall told me that Sheffield's over by Wrigley, the bar was the first beer list, right? Meaning it was this revolutionary thing in like 1991 to actually list out which beers you had.
Right,
we think now
right.
We just go into anywhere. Any restaurant.
It's foreign to not have that.
Yeah.
Right?
So you walk into a place and you'd say, you know, can I see your beer list? Oh, no problem. You know, and they probably got 10 to 30 draft. They've probably got a range of bottles and cans. The younger generation may take that. I just turned 40. The younger generation may take that for granted, but I certainly don't. There were very few options 20 years ago.
Well, I mean, let's talk about the landscape as it is now. I mean, a lot of, like you mentioned, a lot of brewers that come through Goose Island, they move on, they start their own craft beer here in town, elsewhere. But the idea that Chicago has really become a popular destination for craft beer makers, I mean, for companies, the star companies, we have them here on the show,
yep.
Or just the idea that you can, you know, this seems to be becoming an American capital, if you will, for craft beer. Goose Island, how do you keep innovating and keep moving forward as a company when there is attrition like that, when there are a lot of brewers who are like, I want to start my own company, people that you've recruited from the get-go to come in and be part of the company?
Sure. And if somebody's going to, you know, in a certain case, if somebody's got plans to open up their own brewery, you're not going to stop them. It's just what we had an attrition about 3 years ago where we lost 50% of our shift brewing staff in about a 6-week period.
Wow.
Which was, it really hurt us, as you could imagine, because these are the people on shift 24/7. We run 24/7. And they went to other breweries that were opening up or expanding in Chicago. So you're losing brewers locally. You know, if somebody wants to go live in Seattle and brew in Seattle, okay, they're gone. If somebody wants to start their brewery in Chicago, they're gone. But if somebody goes to work another shift brewing job in Chicago, we had to look at ourselves in that period 3.5 to 4 years ago and say, we need to retain brewers. We need to staff up, get trained up, and that takes a very long time. But how do we retain
right.
good brewing talent? Because I think, for me, if I look at consumers, and I interact with consumers quite a bit, their idols are brewers, right? And so I hope they're concerned how their brewers are taken care of. And I'm not saying, you know, I don't want to say that brewers weren't taken care of more than 4 years ago at Goose Island. I think they were compensated fairly, just like in line with any brewery. But I think we have to bend over backwards now and say, you know what? Yes, you're going to be working a shift. You're going to be dragging hoses and dragging pumps around, cleaning tanks. But what's the other element there? It's the creative side.
Right.
It's the creative side. Most brewers these days, young brewers, are coming to breweries with the expectation like, hey, I want to write recipes. I want my chance to make the next.
That's
great
interesting
beer.
Because I mean, Goose Island, as the sort of, like I said, the granddaddy of the craft beer scene here, you've got product
yeah.
in the way that it, you can. I mean, it can go down the line. You got bottles in front of you right now, but yeah. the 312 Honkers, Goose IPA, Bourbon County Stout, Sophie, Matilda. I mean, you have tried and true product that people want. Yeah. How do you promise creativity to brewers coming in when you're at the point where you have stuff that you just need to mass produce?
Well, it's what do we put out? Probably 50 beers in production. Now we've got a tap room. So the last 2 years we've had a tap room at the brewery on Fulton Street and a small R&D plant. Or R&D brewery. So two barrels at a time. So, it's, you know, 62 gallons. So relatively small batches. And so those can be made independent of the big brewery. So we can basically run a small brewery within the big brewery. It doesn't affect production of stuff like Green Line or Sophie, Matilda, those Bourbon County Stout, which we're brewing all the time. Those beers go on. Here, we can brew
independent of that. You can be creative, right.
Be creative. And with really, with, you know, take out the safety net a little bit and just go wild. You know, there's no promises that this beer is going to be served in the tap room. But if it achieves a certain quality, quality is always first. It goes through taste panel, just like any beer, gets approved. Okay, you know, 6 out of 6 agree this should be served in the tap room. Then that beer will move on. It'll graduate, go to the tap room. And that's, again, that's just on site at the brewery. And then occasionally, and again, there's no promises, but occasionally things graduate even further and becomes maybe the next local beer, local draft-only beer. We launch a lot of beers draft-only first. As they say, the bar trade, that volume really kind of dictates if something's going to catch on, and then you'd see it in a package maybe a year later or something.
Mike Siegel is the brewing R&D manager for Goose Island Brewery here in Chicago, Goose Island Beer. As you talk about this, and it's interesting because I don't know a lot about brewing. I don't know a lot about the competition. I know that there's a lot of different beers that have popped up in the last 2-3 years in Chicago. Let me ask you, I mean, so brewers come in. They want to be creative. But you guys, you have a certain, you know, thing that you want to put out. You know, you're Goose Island. You're different. Talk about, you know, there's so many different kinds of beers that'll come out. Whether it's a sour beer, you talked about wit beer. You talked, you know, it could be the next thing that people are interested in. How do you not just sort of jump after every trend, like when you're as big as Goose Island, especially when some of the more flexible breweries, the smaller craft beers, can.
I think we take an approach of what do we want to do, and I think these days, as anyone who looks through a Binny's or any retailer that's selling a lot of craft beer, you can almost see these waves coming. You know, maybe it's a Goza, which is a slightly salty, sour German style beer that was it was almost unheard of 10 years ago. And now it's quite popular. Let's do a fruited Goza. Let's do a fruited IPA. Let's do a hard root beer. You can see these things happening in real time, and we're fortunate enough where we don't have to. We've got some very good selling beers that do well for us and allows us to make some beers that are more passion projects. At the end of the day, we're a business, right? We're not a charity. We do need to sell beer, but when we've got beers like a Goose IPA that's selling just gangbusters nationally, that allows us to have a little bit more freedom to play. We don't have to chase trends. We even though we're owned by Anheuser-Busch, we operate under our own profit and loss, right? And a lot of people may snicker at that, but it is really true. We've got our own company within this much larger company.
I think of breweries and craft beer. I mean, I guess it's not unlike music in the way that when you say people snicker at it, it's because you're on a major label.
Sure.
you're
like Flaming Lips on Warner Brothers.
Right, you know, exactly. Where there's a lot of indies in Chicago that say, hey, we're independent. How do you deal with that? Because you guys paved the way for a lot of those indies.
Yeah, I think when people talk about independence, I say, you know what? I support local businesses that are independent. We aren't independent. I can't give you that, but I'm going to tell you, as I talked about earlier, we take care of our brewers more than we ever have in the company's history, I believe. And that, I believe, should be important to people. That's kind of my mantra these days is we want our brewers to be not only compensated, you know, above fairly, 401k, PTO, all that stuff, great. But again, the creative side that allows them to come in, and not everybody's an expert recipe writer, you know, coming out of the gate. They may think they are, but we've got, led by our brewmaster, Jared Jankowski, who's both an excellent blend of technical brewer and creative brewer. And then we've got a staff. I had to write it down. I'm going to get a post-it note out. When I started 5.5 years ago as a shift brewer, we had 12 shift brewers, 2 leads, and 1 brewmaster. Now we have 26 shift brewers, three leads, one head brewer, one R&D manager, me, and one brewmaster.
Wow.
So at the 30 staff of 32, we had, what did I just add up before, about 14 or 15 5 years ago. So investment in people means, you know what, we care about the people, and I think that hopefully that shows.
One more question for you, and we'll wrap up here. I'm interested. Do you feel that you've been able to expand because there is more of an audience or more of a consumer base for craft beer, or is it the cart before the horse? I mean, did you guys create that audience in the way that I think of some of the craft beer, businesses of the 90s who sort of brought that on? Talk about that concept, the idea that there are so many more people with the palate for craft beer.
I think, you're seeing it with food, of course, the offerings of, it's not just beer, but people are just intrigued by flavor, right? And, my sister-in-law is at KU in Lawrence, and she turned 21 2 years ago, and me and my wife flew down there. We wanted to take her out for her 21st birthday, and there's a little brew pub in town there called Free State, and I thought I was going to be introducing her to craft beer. And I say, order whatever you want off the menu. She orders, give me the barley wine. The 10% big multi barley wine. I didn't know what a barley wine was, I think, until I was like 25. And she's 20, just turned 21. She already knows what a barley wine
right?
is. And I think that's the difference now than 20 years ago is the exposure. These kids, by the time they're of legal drinking age, they're already drinking the good stuff. And they know the differences of an IPA and a Scotch ale. And, whatever, a Goza, and it's fantastic. And it's, of course, education, the internet is great for exposure, ongoing education. But like I said earlier, beer lists, It's just this, I don't know how exactly we got here, but it's a good thing. We got lots of choice. And, again, as a beer lover, I love it. I think it's great times. It's a lot of fun.
Mike Siegel is the brewing R&D manager for Goose Island. Goose Island's got a new beer at Wrigley Field starting when the home opener, of course. It's called 1060 Wit. Wit being more of a white beer. Mm-hmm. Learning here, Mike. Mike Siegel, I can't thank you enough for coming in and being a guest tonight. And
thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My next guest is a hip-hop artist from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Chicago, put your hands together for Webster X.
I explode. I just might explode. And you would know if that's where you would want to go. Furnace. I trust humans too much, but I give up to natural reactions to lead us through the dust and through all the depression. The only I was actually, so I'll just do it my way forever, even if that's the long route together. But I
Webster X is a rapper, he's a poet, an actor, and an experimentalist. He's made his name touring, but also for his great cinematic videos that are attached to his music. He's got a new album coming out called Daymares, which you can find on all the streaming sites, iTunes, Spotify. And he's performing at Metro as part of the closed session show on Friday, the same day that the new album drops.
Indeed.
The Milwaukee product went to high school in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. And he
that
joins
is true.
Me tonight. How are you? Good to
I'm
see
amazing.
You.
I'm amazing, man. You did all your research. The facts are straight.
Good. At least we have that, right?
Yeah.
You know, when I think of hip-hop, I don't necessarily think of Milwaukee.
Yeah,
and I was, to be honest with you, I was like, I don't know why that is.
Mm-hmm.
What talk about the hip-hop scene in Milwaukee.
I mean, it's like me coming from Wichita, Kansas, and people being like, when I think about hip-hop, I don't really think about Wichita, Kansas or anything like that. You know what I'm saying? It's the fact that there are these specific hubs in the nation that people just associate hip-hop with. And at the end of the day, Milwaukee's not mm-hmm. really one of those. But in this day and age, I feel like a lot of people my age and even younger are starting to realize that it really comes from anywhere because of the fact that we're all products of the internet now, you know?
Right.
So I have to thank the internet for my career. I have to thank the internet for a lot of stuff, my relationships, you know what I'm saying? That's just how, like, the world works now. However, I still do like to have, you know, relationships in person with people and stuff like that. And I think that's really what's mixed up for me because, I mean, I'm in Chicago right now doing press right. for the Damers album. That's because of the fact that I'm working with people from Chicago. But at the same time, like, my sound isn't really restricted to just one place. So if people, you know, were to say, I don't really represent the sound of Milwaukee just for the sole fact that there is no true sound from Milwaukee.
Right.
It's really only the sound of the north side. And the north side of Milwaukee is kind of similar to the west side of Chicago. It's like predominantly black. There's some Latinos here and there, yada, yada, yada. But the north side is like, for lack of a better term, it's just like the gutter, more so like true just hustle beginnings of music. It's storytelling, but at the same time, it's like over these like trap sounding beats, you know, whatever it is really is.
It's interesting because do you fashion your work off of the MCs that have come before? Because you're not the first rapper.
Come before Milwaukee?
Yeah. Like I think about like what's your attachment to the sort of the landscape and the history of hip hop in Milwaukee?
So the thing about Milwaukee is when everything really started and kicked off nationally, it was with this guy named Cuckoo Cal. Cuckoo Cal was a rapper who was very popping on like BET, the Hot 100 charts, Billboard, all that stuff with a song called MI Projects, right? But before that, the identity of Milwaukee hip-hop was really just the local scene. The thing about it, though, was, you know, there's these groups called, like, the Rusty Peas. There's these groups from this dude named Prophetic, like, a whole bunch of people. But I just don't think there was enough bridges that were connecting the dots in Milwaukee
right.
for us to be able to really develop a sound early on with hip-hop and try to find our identity. Because in reality, we've always been in somewhat of an identity crisis. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's. I mean, I know that, you know, Chicago, of course, has a huge hip-hop scene, and I think of Minneapolis has a good
100%.
Scene. So you would think that Milwaukee, just being in proximity to two places, would have more, you know, just more identity. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it is that it's been up to you, really, that we haven't seen as much coming out of that city?
Well, the thing is, too, it's not even just up to me because of the fact that I want to pay homage to the people that have come before me. But as far as where the internet took this more so national attention to Milwaukee, myself and this kid named Ishdar, who's about 20 years old, who is touring right now with the group called They, we just kind of took it upon ourselves to try and really make a staple or a destination of some sort with Milwaukee. And not even, I mean, yeah, with Milwaukee hip-hop, but for me personally, I know I'm just trying to expose Milwaukee art. So the arts in Milwaukee, from like the painters, the graphic designers, the videographers, to musicians, to anybody that's doing anything really cool, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and it feels, I mean, that's, I want to make a transition to your music and also to your art and what you do with video work as well.
Yeah.
Webster X in studio, the hip-hop artist from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, got a new album coming out this Friday called Daymares.
Debut!
He's going to be at Metro on Friday with the closed session show. Let's talk about that. I mean, how important is the art scene to you that surrounds not just you as an artist, but as the hip hop scene? How important is it to have all these things happening at the same time in Milwaukee?
It's very inspiring just for the sole fact that the reason why I started was to expose everything that was around me. I thought it was just cool to bring it to attention. That's what felt most pure to me. And that's why I started. So that was in 2013. Where we have come as far as Milwaukee hip hop from 2013 to 2015. Like, 2015 was one of the biggest years for Milwaukee hip hop as far as like just like harnessing national attention and then us using, like, there was a core group of people. Myself, there's a dude named Lord Freddy, there's Ishtar obviously in his whole camp. There's even people like Classic. There's a whole bunch of just, you know, random people that only people in Milwaukee would really know. And those people just, I mean, we just took it upon ourselves to really do something inspiring. So we kept riding off of that wave because it's just, we're bringing what we're bringing to the table. And that what that means is we're bringing ourselves, our own different identities. And it still somehow coincides and works because I think we want to make it work. And from there, yeah, it's just kind of become something more of what you just see and how you interpret it.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk more. I want to talk about your video work. We'll talk about that. And also about, I mean, the hip-hop community in Milwaukee stepping up and being leaders. Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys are the voice. You're the sound.
Yep.
And how that plays out politically. I mean, we saw in the last year some police shootings in Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
Yes, sir.
And we'll talk more about that. Webster X in studio with us. He's got a show on Friday night at Metro, part of the closed session show. And he also has a new album dropping the same day, Daymares.
Yes, sir.
Webster X in
Go
studio.
Go get that Daymares. Don't tweak.
Stay with us.
I don't be lying, dog. I don't be trying too much. This golden path I'm on wasn't always for us. Grab a San Pellegrino.
Say goodbye to my amigos, I am reaping madness, close my eyes. Drift past it now, fade away to the unfound. How you gonna feel when the pressure's too much? These moments are gonna fall while I'm stretching my gut. I'm hitting all at once when these moments are gonna cut. Duck, duck, duck down, I'm shooting rounds. Bullet flew and hit my sound. I took that blow, remain profound. I speak my mind, a foul mouth. Could have been a no, but I rose. Yeah, I'm right now. All this is magic, I don't know, but I'm right now.
Welcome back to Download. Here on 720 WGN, I'm Justin Kaufman. Webster X in studio with me, the hip-hop artist, poet, actor, experimentalist.
I like how you threw an actor in there. That's real, man. I'm trying to get this acting off.
I mean, you're going to be at Metro, with a show with the Closed Sessions guys on Friday. That's the day that the album drops, Daymares. But there is, I mean, let's talk about the videos, because you do these almost cinematic films for your tracks.
100%.
And that's what I, when I say acting, I mean, we're following a storyline. There's it's period pieces. There's costumes. Yep. This is not you in front of a green screen, you know,
just doing whatever,
lip syncing the song. There's a lot that goes into the videos. Where did the concepts come from, and why go there with your art?
The reason why we go there with the art is for the sole fact of symbolism and the power that can bring. So that came from myself, my buddy Damian Blue, my buddy Cody LaPlante. We all just sit together. We listen to my songs. I pretty much present them with the song, and then we think of a really cool treatment to go along with it. The first video we did, called Doomsday, that video primarily was really based off of us just doing cool stuff outside. There was thought put into it. But more so, I remember the first shoot. They just threw me in this like sunroof of my manager's car and the Civic, and they threw the camera on top of the windshield, strapped it on, and I was pretty much, that was the shot of me floating through midair,
or upside
whatever.
Down, right?
Exactly.
Right.
So that was our least storyline based video thus far. Moving on with Lately and Everything, we based those two videos off of the lyrics in a sense, and also the mood of the tracks. So like when I make music, I gravitate towards anthemic and cinematic sounding. Mm-hmm. Production, no matter what, you know, all the beats just kind of have to make me feel so I can write, you know what I'm saying, and it just pours out. So that's kind of how we treat the videos. We let, you know, we literally sit at their crib and process the songs and just talk. We say dumb things, we say genius things.
Well, I mean, you said it. I mean, you write cinematic, and there's something about it. I mean, I guess the question is, do you think about the video when you're writing the song?
Sometimes I also think about the live show too. But the thing about it is, overall, I think what inspires the most is when I'm feeling like the best version of myself. I literally view life as a movie at times. Piecing those things together, like the very, very small things in life, and being able to just really focus on them and kind of soak them in. Like, we were walking over here, I was like, let me just chill for a little bit, like, look at these tall buildings. Like, I don't know, that type of stuff is really what transpires and goes into the music too. So that's why I always say, like, people always ask me, are you inspired by, like, what musicians inspired you to make your sound, yada, yada. And I'm always telling them, it's like humans and life. That's the stuff that inspired me the most. Because I can listen to a whole bunch of different music, but it doesn't mean that I'm necessarily going to make that same type of sound. I still end up somehow making my own
the life
stuff.
Around
so,
you, everything that happens around you is what's inspiring.
So that translates back into the videos. Yeah. Like for the Lately video, for instance, in the beginning when the rose petals falling, I just had that idea from American Beauty. And the rose petals falling, like in that one part where he's like, I think he's daydreaming or like he's sleeping and he's dreaming about the girl. It's like super underage and the rose petals falling. I thought that was beautiful, you know? And we threw in the video and it worked. And then the hole in the ground that I'm coming out of, that pretty much symbolizes the dark hole I was in late 2013 or early 2014, right after my debut mixtape, Desperate Youth. And I was just feeling a lot of pressures and, you know, so on and so forth. And it was my first real dark period of my life, which then pretty much provided half of the themes and ideas for the debut album, Daymares.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, for you as an artist, and I do call you an artist more than just a musician, because you do a lot of different things. But, you know, life is up and down, and it's how you sort of respond to it, you know, adversity or climbing back up. How much does what happens in your regular life, what happens on a day-to-day basis, can we hear in Daymares?
I mean, it makes up most of the album. Daymares at first started as a concept of, you know, things that happened during the day that felt like nightmares, like just walking through life, not wanting to get out of bed, not wanting to really, there was no inspiration during that time. Like, it was a lot of me figuring myself out and going through growing pains. But then over time, because I wrote Daymares from a completely different perspective, I wrote it from a very positive perspective, like me going through the successes of Doomsday and Lately in these videos, like really resonating with people, all that stuff inspired me so much. So it then be kind of over time became a life album. and kind of documented my career from 2013 to 2017, where we are right now. So that's what I really enjoy about Daymares, is it just didn't become complete darkness. It was a balance. It was a duality of dark and light, you know?
Positive and negative, right?
Yeah, exactly. So,
and that's life. That's how we live, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing, too, that really inspired me with that dark period, is because I swear, like, it's so weird. Like, growing up, I mean, I just never really went through anything like that. It was kind of funny to be so naive to just, like, those type of pressures in life. But then you realize, like, everybody goes through that. And when you can make that type of music based off of that, people relate to it even harder. And that's what makes them go hardcore at the shows and all that stuff. Like, I don't know. And especially the live show, too. That's the difference in what I love about my music as a whole, is when I play that live show, all of the lyrics and stuff like that, and even the sounds, they don't really – it's just way crazier in the live show setting. I don't know how else to explain it. Yeah. It's just – it's a thrash. It's high energy. And I think that's the beautiful thing, is you just turn – you take all this – nastiness, you take all the positive, whatever, and you kind of just mold it all together into just one big high energy showing. So
how old are you now? 24?
24, yeah.
So when you did Doomsday, you're what, 21 years old? 22? Yep. I'm interested because, you know, I was reading an article where you said you're ready to step up and be a leader to your community in Milwaukee. And a lot of that, you know, centered around the political chaos that kind of just happened in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee in particular, over a police shooting. Talk about that. I mean, as a hip-hop community, and you as a, it's been around forever, but the idea that there's more light on the hip-hop community now. Do you feel like you need to be a spokesperson for the north side of Milwaukee, for the music, for the political issues that are happening in your hometown?
I do not need to be a spokesperson for the north side, and I do not need to be a spokesperson for any side of Milwaukee. And that's why I try to shy away from it, especially now, because what I've been realizing with this project is that I've been getting asked more questions about that. But more so, what I'm trying to be a leader with is representing a kid from Milwaukee, a perspective of Milwaukee, because of the fact that I'm not trying to be like, yo, y'all, I'm gonna open these doors and you're gonna go through them. Like, yeah, that's, of course, part of it naturally. But what it is, yo, I'm one piece. I need all of y'all to fill in the rest of the pieces. So please tell your story. That's why I celebrate anybody who's really going hard in the city, you know what I'm saying? Overall, I'm just trying to represent one part and piece of Milwaukee, because my background was so diverse, you know?
Right.
So I grew up in the north side of Milwaukee. I went to suburban schools. I knew Jewish kids growing up. My parents are Muslim. They're also Ethiopian. I don't know. It's a big melting pot. So I'm always trying to represent just one aspect. And if that aspect, though, can be a voice that brings more light to Milwaukee, so be it. But I'm not going to sit around and be like, all right, y'all, so I just do all the work, you know, whatever. No, it can't be like that. And I think people understand that.
Yeah, right.
And all I'm trying to do is, like, make these moves so people can be inspired to go make their own.
I like it. Webster X is going to be at Metro on Friday. He is playing.
Turning up. By
the
way,
session,
I'm going to be jumping very high. So if you're going to come to the show, please come ready to jump.
You'll be part of the closed session show that's at Metro Friday. The new record, new album, Daymares, comes out on Friday. Webster X, thanks
yes,
so
indeed.
Much.
Thank
for
you
being
so much
my
for
guest.
Having
I
me, man.
Appreciate it, man.
Shout out WGN.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music and musicians Chicago has to offer here in our All-State Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Tonight, we welcome Chicago-born singer-songwriter Ezra Furman. Furman broke on the indie rock scene over about, I'm going to say, a decade ago with Ezra Furman and the Harpoons. Now he's a solo act, but he also performs with his band, The Boyfriends. He's currently on Bella Union Records, a popular UK outfit. In 2015, he gave us the album Perpetual Motion People. And just last year, the EP Big Fugitive Life. He's played all over the world, including here at Lollapalooza, and he's going to be performing at Coachella coming up next month. Ezra grew up in Evanston with his three siblings, and he's in studio tonight with his acoustic guitar. He's ready to play for us. Here's the track, The Hour of Deepest Need.
Okay. Start things slow. I think it's time you brought your face across the railroad to my place. I can't share this whiskey with you through the phone. And if we drink enough of it, you might just get me to admit that I never knew quite how to be alone. We can sit on my back steps and intertwine our fingertips while you talk about the nice things that you once had. And if the turntable still starts, you can teach me how to waltz, and I'll teach you how to feel really, really bad. Sometimes the wound hurts powerful indeed, but sometimes you just got to let that sucker bleed. When the sun drags in the day, will you be a thousand miles away in the hour of my deepest need? Well, they pile up around you, the good and evil things you do. And the piles grow up higher with every breath. When you're down between two mountains and you're 29 and counting, that's the valley of the shadow of death. Oh. Can watch the silver moon and I'll fall asleep too soon while the porch light draws the horseflies to their fate. Yeah, cause sometimes your company is just the thing to comfort me, but other times all I can do is just sit and wait. Yeah, sometimes the wound hurts powerful indeed, but sometimes you just got to let that sucker bleed. And when the sun drags in the day, will you be a thousand miles away in the hour of my deepest need?
That's it.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. That's great. Ezra Furman live in studio 435 to track Hour of Deepest Need off the album Perpetual Motion People. We'll get Ezra on the table here, and then we will have a conversation. We'll hear some more live music here in studio 435 right after this break. Stay with us.
Are you in the market?
Something for you, Ezra. Ezra Furman in studio at Studio 435, 720 WGN. Ezra Furman, longtime singer-songwriter. Played with the Ezra Furman and the Harpoons, Ezra Furman and the Boyfriends. You just heard him doing acoustic solo off the track Hour of Deepest Need, off the track the album Perpetual Motion People, the EP Big Fugitive Life. It's great to have you here. I've always been a fan of your music. Thanks for coming in. It means a lot.
My pleasure. I just took the bus down from uptown.
There you go. That's how we like it. That's how we like our musicians taking the bus right down to Michigan Avenue. All right. So talk about, I mean, listening to the music, I was struck by the fact that there is a significant growth in your career. How, I mean, I said at the beginning, it's over a decade from when you were playing the early stuff when you were kid playing with the Harpoons. And that was a lot. That was great stuff, but it was a lot of sort of, you know, I don't know how to even categorize it, but it was more a boom bop, like you know, like I don't know how to say it, but the point being, like, listening to the growth and the emotional growth of your songwriting. Talk about that. Talk about the you know, what you've learned over the last 10 years of being a professional musician.
Oh, learned a lot. I mean, seen the world. You know, like, just a wild thing to do with your time, to be in a touring band. We've toured a lot. But I came at it, what I wanted to be most of all is a great songwriter. It's like, that's what I was into. I got into the idea of being a great songwriter when I was a teenager, and I was far from it then. Although I probably thought I was pretty good. None of that stuff really survived. But that is the thing that I feel like, honestly, most proud of, and I've really grown at doing. I mean, along the way, I've also gotten way better at performing, I think. Mm-hmm. And hitting notes. Or at least knowing when I hit the wrong note. That's a big step.
That's a good lesson, right? Take us back to the dorm room. I mean, when you guys were starting out, when you were Tufts and you were just working out the music, I mean, what brought you guys together, the band, but also what brought you to the music?
Well, so I was into songwriter stuff. I mean, I was into Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen and John Lennon and Randy Newman and Joni Mitchell. I don't know, the greats, you know? And I was like, what is it? What are these greats doing? How do they do that? How do they write that well? And I was like, I thought of it as a writer. I didn't think of myself as a musician. I was like a writer.
You were like a poet.
Played guitar also. Know about a poet, but like a songwriter, you know, just that's all I wanted to be. And I refused to form a band, although I loved, you know, I always loved rock and roll, punk rock, and all kinds of different kinds of music. But like, I don't do that. I'm not gonna form a band. People form a band and then all they can think about is the tone of their reverb pedal, and you know, they forget to write good songs. So I was like, I'm just gonna focus on songwriting. But my band, the Harpoons, they were like, they were already a band together, like playing frat parties, having a ball. I would go see them. They were really great, just like wild, a bunch of covers, some originals. And they were like, you know what? Like, you actually write great songs. We should become your band. And I was like, I don't know. And they kind of talked me into it. And I'm so glad that, like, I just started learning a ton about
music, about chemistry,
about music, getting things across. What a drummer can do to the experience of listening to a song.
Watching you perform right now? You're very, I could tell you're a performer, you're a seasoned performer. You even with just us as the audience and in the studio, maybe some passerbys, you're putting it all in, even in an acoustic performance. Was that something that came to you organically when you were a kid? Or were you a good performer, or were you the opposite of that? Were you shy?
I had the nerve, as they say. That's what you need to play rock and roll. I think, I can't remember what I'm quoting. Some Lester Bangs thing probably, but you don't need anything. You don't need any talent. You need the nerve. I had the nerve to do it and like the, I don't know. It just takes a certain kind of like guts and a certain kind of look at me. You should watch me do this thing, which is sort of an embarrassing trait to have, you know. Performers,
yeah,
have that. It's not to say I'm not shy, because I'm incredibly shy and I get very much serious stage fright just before going on, but like adrenaline kicks in and that the nerve.
There's a difference between
up.
Nerves and nerve.
That's right, right. Yeah.
Ezra Furman's my guest in Studio 435 tonight. His album in 2015, Perpetual Motion People. It's great, great reviews, great album. Last year, the EP Big Fugitive Life, which was an extension of that album. We'll talk about that after the break. He's coming up. He's playing at Coachella, coming up here in April.
Can't believe it.
Yeah, there you go. And he's live tonight. Let's get you back on the microphone. What are we going to hear?
Yeah, this is one from that EP called Penetrate. And I mean, just so you know, we also play loud rock and roll music, you know. Coming here tonight, there's a mysterious nighttime feeling that I'm tapping into.
All right.
Penetrate.
Yeah. Ezra Furman, Penetrate, off the EP Big Fugitive Life. He said he just got back from New York last night, and he is heading out to Coachella in April. But he's our guest here at Studio 435. Ezra Furman.
Penetrate my body, penetrate my mind. Penetrate to the center, leave the rest of it behind. Burn away all the excess that no longer applies. I've been changed, my Lord, I've been changed. Have a cold cup of coffee at 4:45. Spit your blood in the toilet while you watch the big sunrise. Better learn how to run now that there's nowhere to hide. Happy day, oh happy day. All the boys and the girls learn to penetrate so young. And the men and the women hit the town and have their fun. And when they all hear my record, they will know what I have done. I've been changed, my Lord, I've been changed. Penetrate my country, penetrate my home. Steal away in the nighttime to the ocean white with foam. Sail away on the ocean, meet your maker on your own. Happy day, oh happy day.
Penetrate, Ezra Furman. Yes. Studio 435. He is in studio tonight. His EP, Big Fugitive Life. He's got some shows in California, including Coachella, coming up in April. We'll take a quick break. We'll get Rob Snooze. We'll come back, and we will talk more and hear another track from Ezra Furman here in Studio 435. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. Studio 435, Ezra Furman, Chicago singer-songwriter in studio. Ezra, of course, was Ezra Furman in the Harpoons. Also performs with his band Ezra Furman and the Boyfriends. He is here solo tonight. His EP, just out in 2016, Big Fugitive Life. He's performing in California. Got some California dates and Coachella coming up here in April. Big gigs. I mean, I mentioned, you know, you've done things like Lollapalooza. You tour all over the the world. I mean, you've got gigs coming up, London, other places. I mean, Bella Union's a huge record label out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's big for you. I mean, talk about the life on the road. I mean, you spent a lot of your life outside of Chicago.
Yeah. No, I spend most years I'm gone for like a third of the year. And I got to tell you, touring is like the way we do it. It's just, it's low budget. It's sleeping on floors. It's exhausting. You know, even, I mean, we're doing a little better now in the last few years, especially if you like go to England, Europe. They tend to more like,
they treat you better?
They treat you better. I mean, like in America, they're just like, I don't know. You can each have half a bottle of water. And I don't know. It's just like, it's kind of brutal some places. Some of the divey places we play in America. Also, we're oddly sort of more popular in Europe.
Do you think that's because of the record label? Why do you think that is? Because I agree with you. I was looking at all this stuff. I'm like, you've got a lot of buzz there.
It's not the label. I mean, the label came after the popularity in the UK. And I'm not sure what it is. And frankly, it's not my job to know or care. I don't analyze it. I don't analyze it.
How do you? I mean, I'm interested. I mean, you've lived two lives in the way that you were, you know, I talked to you, you've been in the business now for a while. I mean, you did music in the early 2000s. Talk about the concept of being a musician, a professional musician then, and dealing with record labels and Minty Fresh and other places like that, and now. You know, and we're being a more DIY, and the music industry is gone, and it's not like it was. I mean, what are the differences for an Ezra Furman?
Well, I mean, the differences for me aren't that big, I think, because I was with indie labels then, indie labels now. I never was exposed. I have some friends who've been like on major labels and would have like a label spending thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars on them and on their record, you know, take 6 months to record the drum parts or whatever. And they've got crazy stories of like music business excess. For me, it's always been just like, so like, can you play 300 shows a year or 350? And it's like, just working hard, doing it.
Because that's how you make money.
Grimy.
That's how you make money as a musician. You have to be on the road. You have to do shows, and you have to pick up cash that way.
That's one way. I mean, as things as years have gone on, I've realized that I am not gonna stay sane if I tour as much as I used to. And we need to, you know, remember to take care of ourselves. You kind of, when you're starting to hear about shows, you want to sign up for all of it, and you're like, let's just like be out there and go for it hard. And
right.
Then you forget that like just like a few weeks in, you hit this point of total exhaustion and despair, and like you're like, why did we go to this town exactly where no one likes us, and or like whatever, you know, you just got to be a little more strategic about it to stay to keep loving it, you know. But I do like the dingy shows. I like this I like small venues, and I like shows without even that many people there. It's just like one of my favorite things in life is to play a show with a great band, which I happen to be blessed with a great band,
you know. Looking at your career, and you've done a lot of stuff. I mean, and here you are. I mean, it's kind of funny because you're like, hey, it's slowed down. You know, now I'm taking care of myself. Yet before the show, you told me last night you got in today from New York, right?
That's,
I mean,
right.
You were playing last night. I mean, you're, I mean, it's hard to shake it after a while. You, even though it might be a less in your mind, you're still performing a lot.
Yeah. This year is going to be a kind of a watershed. We're like, we're really not touring much at all. I mean, we're playing some festivals. We're playing Coachella. It's really exciting. We're doing some like shows that pay kind of more, and we're basically focusing on new stuff, recording new music, really taking time.
That's something. I mean, I was reading somewhere the fact that when you were touring a ton, you were able to still pop out records. You know, like you were able to do, like even when you were in the midst of those 300-350 shows, you know, you and the band found place to actually create music. Talk about your music, because over time, I've seen your work change with the Harpoons to the Boyfriends to what you do in your solo work. And it's almost like chapters in the way that, you know, the last chapter, and we just heard the two songs. We heard Penetrate and we heard earlier Hour of Deepest Need. There's something deeper. I mean, first of all, explain to us what you were singing about and what chapter it is that you just wrapped up. And then tell us what's next for you. What's the next chapter for Ezra Furman?
You know, it's funny. Those couple of songs may be more leaning toward the future than the chapter that we've been in is like kind of a wild rock and roll band. Some sort of, I don't know, a real kind of joy and exuberance. And even the kind of like pop music silliness, like amidst all the, I mean, as a songwriter, I try to be for real, and you know, I mean, do what the greatest songs do, which is like address deep human truths, like things that you need music to go beyond words to address. But nevertheless, like I just think this past chapter has been about being like a fun rock and roll band.
And you hear that. You hear that on Perpetual Motion People.
Yeah. No, when I show up at night at a radio station alone with a guitar, it's like that mood doesn't maybe come through so much. But that's mostly
When you're taking time, like you just said, which is somewhat unusual for you to take months at a time to work on a new project.
Highly unusual.
What do we expect? I mean, what is it when I break it down into chapters? What's the next chapter? What I mean, are you still going after those human truths that you can only sing about, that you have to go deeper? Is it a little bit of nighttime music, a little bit of pop culture, pop music silliness?
I'm really interested in storytelling right now. A lot of my music has been some kind of, it's been pretty confessional and personal and talking about my actual life, although sort of in this heightened way that, you know, deviates from the plain truth to get to a truer truth, but that was a weird thing to say, being cryptic. But I think I'm really interested in storytelling right now, like how a song tells a story. I think that's one of the best things that songs can do, is to tell a story in a way that's more intense or intense in a different way than that story could be told without music.
Do you?
So I'm actually, yeah, I'm writing less expository autobiographical things and more working on character, working on...
Is that hard?
Kind
of
fiction.
Is it hard? Because, I mean, you came up with this idea that you're not necessarily a poet, but a writer, and you wrote a lot about your life, and a lot of your music is... like you said, semi-autobiographical. Like, is it hard as a songwriter to make that transition to write for somebody else, for a character, for a different story?
Well, yeah. Well, it's my default, or it's sort of like a nervous tick to confess and to talk about myself. And maybe I've just done enough of it. And also, you really want to be a writer, like, you have to start thinking about fiction at some point. I mean, I'm a deep reader and I'm an avid fiction reader, and I like kind of like, you know, was thinking about writing prose, but writing a novel or something, and I was like, I think I could use my skill set, which is songwriting, see if I can do a novel and song, some kind of thing like that. Not that, don't get any ideas. We're not going to necessarily make some rock opera or something like that.
You heard it here first. Ezra Furman's my guest, a longtime singer-songwriter here in Chicago. His album in 2015, Perpetual Motion People, and his last year he did the EP Big Fugitive Life. He's got a big show coming up at Coachella, which is, Coachella is a big gig for you. It's also something you know, on Twitter, you kind of went after saying you're not necessarily that happy. The money's good, but you're not that happy because some of the politics involved.
Yeah, it's a complicated thing. Coachella is run by this company, Golden Voice, which is run by a guy named Philip Anschutz, who is like, he's sort of the profile of an enemy of mine. You know, he's donated a lot to
anti-LGBT.
Right, anti-LGBT, you know, organizations and right-wing things. He's in charge of Anschutz Exploration, which is like his oil drilling into fracking, like sues whole towns for not letting them do fracking in their town, and like just kind of things that I think are ruining the world. And I am playing at an event that is like lining his pockets. So yeah, that makes me uncomfortable. We accepted the gig before I knew about that. I think I probably would have accepted it anyway. Well, full disclosure.
As an artist, I mean, you have to make, especially an artist that has success, you have to make those hard decisions because there's a lot of money on, you know, for you and your bandmates versus sort of taking a political stand.
Sure. Yeah. I really, actually hearing about what was going on with it, I thought about dropping out of the lineup. It's a complicated thing. Maybe don't have time to fully explicate my whole view of what it is to live in this, in a world where good and evil, you know, intertwine constantly and go dancing together. But let's just say I prefer to make my views on these things known, and I suppose, like, we gotta eat, you know. We go to the gas station and patronize Shell and BP because we gotta get somewhere, and it's too far to walk, you know. It's a tricky thing. There's moral conundrums all over the place in this.
Well, maybe
world.
Maybe we'll have you back and we'll do a moral conundrum show.
Yeah. Hey, well, let's do 12. Let's do a series.
Let's do a series. Ezra Furman, the Chicago singer-songwriter, in Studio 435 tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get one last track from Ezra. Stay with us. Studio 435 here on the download. Ezra Furman live with his guitar. He took the bus down. We appreciate it, as always. Ezra Furman, his EP, Big Fugitive Life, was out last year. He's working on new music. He's going to be at Coachella coming up here in April. All right, so let's get a last track. What are we going to hear, Ezra?
This is Wild Feeling, which is a song I used to do with the Harpoons, and it sort of mutated more recently into a different kind of thing. It was in a major key, and now it's in a minor key. I would say This is about a feeling that won't leave me alone. Wild feeling hit me hard in the night. I looked out on my green backyard in the night. My little eyes suddenly starred in the night, began to grow. I stood in that lit window frame in the night. I danced just barely like a flame in the night. And if you ever feel the same in the night, let me know. An inconvenient thing arose in my heart the day you went and stuck your nose in my heart. And all the cold things that had frozen my heart melted down. Melting ice had formed a pool in my heart, and something warmed all that was cool in my heart. I realized I had been a fool in my heart until now. And so as I wait for wisdom to arrive, I try to live and feel alive. Try to remember all that's died and gone. But there are certain secrets no one knows. A wild feeling grows and grows, and love's a kite that blows and blows. But hold on, hold on. I know I can't deny in my room. The angels sing to me and fly in my room. I open up my little eye in my room after sunset. But in the morning I go out of my room. The world of men fills me with doubt of my room. That's why I've got a song about my bedroom, so I don't forget. Right. I don't see defeat or despair in the world. I don't see things that are not there in the world. I'm just a kid without a care in the world, all a spin. But if you ever feel alone in the world, well, you can call me on the phone in the world. I know you're just like me, no home in the world but the wind. And we are entering wild age. The words will rise up from the page. A great storm so long hushed will rage again. And honesty will make us free. Streams that take us to the sea will overflow, and that will be the end. The end.
Yeah. There you go, Ezra Furman, Studio 435. His EP, Big Fugitive Life, that was a song that was redone from his days back with the Harpoons. We're getting nostalgic there. Ezra, can't thank you enough for coming in studio and being our guest tonight, Studio 435. Always a fan of your music. It means a lot that you came down. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. Patty Vasquez coming up next.